Earth Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
The spice expands life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to
we explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. In here, the results are always positive, so recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. There are 10, count them, 10 sunspot clusters on the sun today. The most I have counted since doing this program. A full 8 years this September. The solar wind is a brisk 340 kilometers per second, and Venus, Jupiter, and Mercury are converging for a beautiful sunset conjunction. So you might want to just step out during the break and have a look at it. The show begins on May 11th, which was yesterday, and climaxes in 2 weeks. So if you miss it tonight, no problem. Should be beautiful weather all this week, somewhere in the country. An unstable filament of magnetism on the Earth side of the sun erupted during the early hours of today. The erupting filament did not spark a significant solar flare. That is, there was no strong flash of X radiation. But it did hurl part of itself into space. Everyone, especially solar scientists, are watching for the next flare. How will our electronic world be affected by this? Well, that's a good question. I think it's more to do with the individual than it is the technology. If your birthday was before 1965, I would say you can recover nicely. If you were born after 1980, I would say your whole social world is going to do a huge Control-Alt-Delete without a reboot. Kind of came across this the hard way one time when I was trying to teach my kids something. I said, just turn it clockwise. But they looked at me with the most puzzling blank look on their face. Like, what are you talking about clockwise? But it's true. They had been using digital watches their whole lives. I had no idea what clockwise meant. By the way, tonight NASA launched rockets to release vapor clouds in the atmosphere for a wind experiment that could make your satellite navigation more accurate. NASA's experiment will allow scientists to chart winds in the high atmosphere. Winds can interfere with GPS signals, introducing errors of up to half a mile. You ever had your GPS say to you, you have arrived at your destination, and you look around and you're not at your destination? Well, the rockets release clouds that can be tracked from the ground, and it will allow a better understanding of why satellite signals are disrupted by these high winds. Of course, it couldn't have anything to do with the fact that we're dumping billions of watts into the ionosphere and upper troposphere that has no way of escaping. And we're not the only ones doing it. Several countries are doing it as well. Lots of interesting stuff going on up there. I do know that Paul Orlando Smith is in the process of filming a new updated documentary. Those of you that saw and loved Holes in Heaven, you'll remember the documentary that came out in 1997. If you've been to a conference somewhere, you've seen the tape for sale. It had Patrick Flanagan, myself, Nick Begich, Gene Manning, several of the contributing scientists, as well as one-of-a-kind interviews for the folks up at the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program up in Alaska. Very revealing, very telling stuff. Well, this documentary is going to take it to the next level. The production is much better. The science is much more accomplished. The data that we have is much more telling. So should be a very, very good documentary. I do know that it's in production right now. We'll watch for it, won't we? I have a currency war update. Yes, those of you that listen to this program know that one more war update has been added to X Squared Radio, and that is the currency war. What is a currency war? Well, a lot of you are way too young to remember. I am too, because the last one was in 1931. A currency war is where one country literally takes a predatory position with their currency in the market. That's a trading currency. It forces all the other currencies in the world to try to compensate for that value. This is quite involved. It's a very complicated mathematical algorithm, and it's a dangerous game that countries play. As you know, if you listen to the last presidential campaign, several of the candidates tried to label China as a currency manipulator. Well, you know, look who's calling the kettle black. We all manipulate our currencies. We all, once we detached the value of currency from precious metals, gold and silver, it could float to basically whatever the Fed wanted it to float to. Well, the same thing happens with other countries. And traders, that is to say, investors that buy and sell currency, they buy and sell dollars and euros and yen and yuan, which is the Chinese money, and even Indian rupees, back and forth, dozens of little micro trades all every week, making just a fraction of a percent here and there. But the computer programs are so fast and they're so precise in their buying and selling in these micro trades that these accounts can make upwards of 30, 40, 50%. A month, not a year, a month. That means if you're doing 30% a month times 12, that's 360% annual. Now you know why you can't go to the bank and get a loan, because they're all trading your currency. Every deposit that you put in the bank is going in that game. Well, the Dow Jones Industrial Average this week closed above 15,000 points for the first time Tuesday, piercing another record threshold as investors' fear of missing out on the rally has replaced potential customers and concerns about the risk of a sell-off. So they're really playing a dangerous game. We played it when you were kids. It's called the hot potato. Everybody holds onto the potato and tosses it to the next person and the next person. And the person that's caught with the potato when the game is over is the big loser. Musical chairs is another game, except, you know, you keep removing the chairs each time. These records have been broken all week. I expect them to be broken as well next week. Even Tesla broke $80 for brief moments this week. Which, by the way, at least in the electric vehicle community, there was a lot of cheering over this, even though, you know, earnings are projected and not actually realized yet, even though production is up on the vehicles. It isn't the actual value that really is energizing the cheering section. What's energizing the cheering section is the fact that the naked short traders got fried this week. Oh, they went away licking their wounds in all corners of the planet. How much stock was shorted of Tesla? Well, we just happen to have a little bit of information on that. 40%. Does that not stagger you? Is that not stunning? 40% of the stock that Tesla has on the market is made up of phantom shares. They're phony. They're counterfeit. They're put out there by short traders, naked short traders, who sell short Tesla stock, but they don't own it. Well, you taught them a lesson this week because you drove Tesla stock to $82 briefly this week. And what does that do? That forces the naked short traders to have to go buy the stock in order to deliver it. Because, as you know, naked short trading is failure to deliver. It's illegal. And if the stock goes up, well, then the exchange calls the account due. And that means you have to go buy the stock. You have to spend the money. So those short traders that were naked shorting Tesla stock, 40% of it, got hit very hard. And it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of fellas. Well done, Elon Musk. Now, the Dow is off to its fastest start to any year since the raging bull market of 1999. You remember that market, don't you? We called it the dot-com bubble or whatever you wanted to call it. Yet, sentiment seems far from the kind of blind optimism that fueled the technology stock bubble, because this I am including in the currency war update, because there isn't really value to drive these stocks higher. They're not selling any more than they were. Well, they may have laid off a few thousand people, making their profits a little bit better. But the actual value in the stocks is not there. What is there is the price. Is the price. And this fits the pattern of three recessions back to back, and then a huge bubble in the stock market. Just look at it. Look at your town. Look at your village. Look at your city. Look at your state. Is it really booming like that? Do you really have 2, 3, 4, 5% unemployment? No. You're still at 10 to 15% employment. Truth be told, if you want to do a racially balanced unemployment rate, in some states it's as high as 20%. That has not been known in this country since the Depression. And numbers like that actually didn't exist in the Depression, because during the Great Depression of 1929, that lasted till solidly till 1933, until the government got some programs in place to put people sort of back to work, the problem was that all those jobs were lost in the cities where the factories were. But on the farms, in the small towns, they weren't hit like that. Yes, prices still dropped, but people were working. There were still trees being cut down. There was still wheat being planted. There was still, you know, cabbage being grown and shipped. People still had to eat. Farms were doing fine. The rural communities were doing fine. They were much more self-sufficient then than they are today. What we have today is a nice, clean 10% unemployment to 25% unemployment, and it affects everyone, even the rural communities. So in a lot of ways, this is a much worse economic condition for the middle class than it was during the Depression. Although the middle class, it can be said, evaporated during the Depression, it's trying to do that as well now. The only thing that's not doing it is the banks haven't foreclosed on all the homes that they have in their inventory, mainly because Congress has passed laws to agree not to bail out the banks again, so they kind of have to bleed it into the system. And the other reason is that there's no money to loan small business. Oh, there's tons of small business out there wanting to get going. They're wanting to hire people. They're wanting to expand. They want to buy equipment and buildings and land, and they want to put things together and get things on the shelves. But they can't, because there's no money to do it with. They have to rely on sales, which are meager at best. So when you look at the entire picture, a raging stock market, but a very sluggish manufacturing community, we're at the same manufacturing job level as we were in 1965. Hello, this is 2013. It's 48 years later. We should have a lot more manufacturing jobs, but we don't. So the latest leg higher in the rally has been led by stocks favored in cautious strategies. In fact, if you look at the Fortune 500, the top five companies have not changed since the Fortune 500 was formed. The stocks that are leading are the ones that are paying high dividends, and investors continue to pour money into the perceived safety of bond, mutual funds, you know, those pesky 401ks, despite extremely low yields. And I'd put a capital E on that extremely. We're talking about 1%, 1.5%. This is very low. This is not the kind of return you want to see on bonds, but they're still pouring money into them because they perceive them to be safe. Because if the market slides, then the bonds are going to go up. And that's why people are buying them, because it's cheap, like cheap gold and cheap silver. Still, traders say the stock market's march into record territory has been fed by a stream of willing buyers whenever prices retreat or whenever short traders dump a bunch of shares into the market. That includes smaller investors, middle-class investors who are playing the market, who in recent years, since the 2008 financial crisis, had shunned U.S. stocks. Investors have played the worry game, and those that have sat on the sidelines in cash are starting to question that, because this has been a pretty resilient market, said Sean Lynch, global investment strategist at Wells Fargo Private Bank, which oversees about $170 billion in assets. Well, the interesting thing, Mr. Lynch, is there's about $3.5 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars, sitting on the sidelines in cash in the United States. Who's it held by? Well, it's not held by me. It's not held by most of the listeners to BBS Radio, which, by the way, my good Earth Explorers, is factually the largest supplier of live content on the web in the world, bar none. So you're in the right place if you're listening to X Squared Radio. We're right up there at the top echelon of all programming on the BBS Radio Network. We're on one night a week live, Sunday night. But lots of this programming is on every single day or 5 days a week. These hosts are really delivering some outstanding programming, and BBS Radio, through the love of their hearts and their great skill and technology, has been delivering it now, at least as far as I'm concerned, for over 8 years. And it's live radio, which is something you don't get much except in the smaller markets. This is a huge market. This is a global market. By the way, if you're an investor or you're an advertiser and you want to reach a global market, it's right here, right here. BBSradio.com. And don't forget to mention you heard it right here on X Squared Radio. Now, let's look a little bit more at this algorithm, because people don't know really how the stock market works. Who's the wizard? Who's the guy behind the curtain that's pulling all the strings, that's making all those numbers go up and down, making those traders go crazy on the floor, you know, betting the farm and betting their children's futures on whether a stock will go up and down? The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed over 15,000 for the first time on Tuesday, as I said, and it is going to rage up and down for a while. If you remember, the Dow's jumped for the first time over 11,000, that's 4,000 points ago, over 4,000 points ago, because it's now 16,000. On May 3rd, this month, in 1999, nobody had ever dreamed that the stock market could go that high before. Now, you remember that bubble, don't you? I mean, Senator Maria Cantwell in Washington State made her millions in the dot-com bubble. She sold off at exactly the right amount of time, capitalized herself, ran for Senate in Washington, and has been successful ever since. Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla, the CEO of SpaceX, made all his money in PayPal, which is an online bank. It's a bank with no walls. It has over 75 million depositors, probably close to 90 million depositors now. If you buy something on Amazon, you probably pay with it for PayPal, with PayPal. If you have a small business online where you're selling things yourself, you probably have a bank account with PayPal. That all came from that dot-com bubble. Fewer than 5% of those companies are still in business. Everyone either lost their shirts or made a fortune during that bubble. Was there any value there? Well, yeah, there was, if you saw the value in a 17-year-old CEO whose office was in the folds of a laptop. Sure, there was value. But it created a phenomenon. It created something where actual small business, smart entrepreneurs could make something for themselves if they were in the right place at the right time. Well, Tuesday's rally, which nudged the Dow up 87 points, which was followed Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, or almost 0.6%, was the latest accomplishment for a four-year stock rally that has sent the Dow up nearly 130% without suffering a single bear market downturn, typically defined as a decline of 20% or more from a recent high. Amid the rally, the blue chip measure hasn't suffered a three-day losing streak. And get this, 87 days. It's the longest such run since 1958. It has been nearly 6 months since the Dow have suffered even a 5% decline. And the last 10% drop took place in the summer of 2011 when the index lost 17%. But that's as the European debt crisis flared up and the U.S. government's debt rating was downgraded. What's happening here? That's a very good question, because you're seeing a disconnect, an economic disconnect between what's happening with the Dow, which is actually a false indication of what the economy is doing, and what's really going on Main Street. You got Wall Street on the left hand, and you got Main Street on the right hand. If you don't know what's going on, you're a governor, you're a mayor, you're a banker, you're an investor, I want you to get in your car and you drive around your town. Drive around your city. Look at how many malls are empty. Look how many strip centers have one or two stores in them and they're subprime stores. The anchors are gone. Look how many people are washing cars in the parking lot of that mall downtown. Then drive to the more affluent centers of your city. Look at the new office buildings. Look at the new banks. Look at the condos. Lots and lots of vacancy signs. Lots and lots of changing hands of real estate. People buying hotels and selling hotels. People buying hospitals and selling hospitals. You see what's going on there? What's going on there is investors are moving in with cash and they're buying things up at pennies on the dollar, fractions of what they were worth 3 or 4 years ago. Why are they able to do that? Because they're making tons of money by gambling. They're gambling one with another on the stocks. It has nothing to do with the value of that company whatsoever. Do you really seriously think that Tesla deserves an $82 stock? Seriously? They haven't made a profit except for one quarter in 13 years. Seriously? An $82 stock? I mean, we'd like it, but let's be reasonable. Encouraging economic reports from outside the U.S. and new highs on Germany and Japan stock markets helped push markets up on Tuesday. That's what I want to talk about. Where is the high in Japan's stock market coming from? It's coming because Japan is leading this currency war. They just changed prime ministers. And what is happening is the new prime minister has taken a different tactic than his predecessor. His predecessor really fought an 18-year recession by trying to build value in the country and trying to build value in their economy. Now, the interesting thing is that when they went into this recession, they had four of the most profitable car companies in the world. Their debt, their national debt to their gross domestic product was only 5%. Their people were among the most highly educated and highly paid in the world. If you wanted to do business, the place to do it was with Japan. Toyota, Honda, Panasonic, Sharp. Every single major corporation that was dominating the world at that time was Japanese. You know it, and I know it. So they went into the recession with that strength, and look at them now. Their debt to GDP is almost 300%. Their unemployment rate, is astronomical, two digits plus. Their salaries have not changed in 15 to 18 years. Their education rate, their export rate, everything is suffering. The new guy, the new prime minister that's come in has decided to start printing money, printing yen. And what that has done is it has forced the value of the yen down. What it's done is it's made it less expensive for people to do business in Japan. And so in they come. They're pouring money into Japan. In recent months, the blue chip Dow has seemed particularly impervious to economic and political headwinds. The Dow is already up 15% this year, despite a battle in Congress over the federal deficit and a banking crisis in Cyprus. We talked about a month ago, the great bank heist in Cyprus, where not only did the government close the bank, the IMF forced the closure of the bank, of course, after their rich friends were allowed to get their money out. But they didn't take the taxpayers' money. They took the depositors' money. Yeah, they took the depositors' money to recapitalize the bank. And that, of course, was not enough. And so Cyprus began selling off its gold. And that forced the price of gold down around the $1,400 range, which Reuters and Bloomberg called a panic mode. We still think that if the actual physical sale of gold does take place, right now just threats have been made, and same thing with Japan, all it takes is a threat of that and the price of gold drops. When the actual physical metal starts hitting the market, and it won't be bought up by you or me, trust me, it'll be bought up by Putin and Britain and other countries that are well capitalized that will move in and buy that gold. What will happen is the price will probably drop to about $1,175, $1,180. So look for that to happen. Silver has already suffered its fall. It's come all the way down to $23 an ounce, although good luck buying it at that price. You might be able to buy paper silver, that's bullion, tradable documents, but the physical metal, you're not going to touch it for under $31 to $32 an ounce. Trust me. By the way, I'm putting my silver on eBay next week for $140 an ounce. Any takers? Just let me know. As a sign of how quickly the recent gains have come, the Dow first cleared the 14,000 level in July of 2007. Then the housing-fueled stock rally was just reaching its peak. After the financial crisis, stocks tumbled by 54% before taking the next 4 years to reclaim the 14,000 level again. That was February 1st of this year, just 3 months ago. In contrast to all the other rallies that we've had, because currencies are doing what they're doing, it took just 66 days to burst from the 14,000 level to the 15,000 level. Unprecedented. With cash and money market funds yielding investors next to nada, nothing, zero, not maybe not zero, but 0.5%, 1%, and treasury yields near historic lows, more investors are deciding stocks are the best place to put their money. Even with a U.S. economy that has struggled to build momentum and relatively weak earnings news. So, what you're seeing is currency trading and stock certificates, which is another form of currency. It's just money. Stock certificates are just cash, all right? It's liquid money. Its value fluctuates a lot more than the dollar, but it's still money. A publicly trading company, when they print stock, when they issue stock, it's just printing money. All that money is starting to burn a hole in people's pockets, Mr. Pace says. People talk about there being no alternatives to stock, and there's an element of truth to that. Well, that's true. There is, however, hang on a second. There is, also, however, something to consider here, and that is that people are not spending this money. You know, when you buy silver, It is a storage metal. It's not a metal that you can just buy and sell. Oh, you could do it, but it's not very smart. You want to buy it cheap and you want to hold on to it. It's a hedge against long-term inflation. It's a savings account, something maybe you want to pass on to your kids. But if silver goes from $23 an ounce where it is now to $140 an ounce, which is where it should be, you're going to see a lot of people cashing in. It's important because that silver needs to get back in the market. Right now, it's not in the market. Well, last month, the Deutsche team, you know, the people at Deutsche Bank, which managed $60 billion in assets, decided to increase its allocation to, you guessed it, stocks. When you have banks putting their money in stocks, now you have the stage set. Because when the stocks fall, so will the bank. It's now debating whether to push that allocation even higher. If we think the risks have really come down, that could get us higher on stock valuations, said Mr. Pace with Deutsche Bank. So, how do the currency wars affect the mega rich? What do the private investors do that are very wealthy? Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Mr. George Soros is the currency trading champion of the last 25 years. Hang on one moment. Highly recommend grapefruit juice on ice. It's so good. Mr. George Soros, as you remember reading the news a long while back, he actually broke the Bank of England single-handedly just by trading. Rumors are circulating that the billionaire investor George Soros made $19 million in just 36 hours by betting that the Australian Federal Reserve would cut interest rates. The Sydney Morning Herald reports. On Monday, a trader in Hong Kong, believed to be from Soros' investment firm, placed a $1 billion bet, a wager, on the Australian dollar dropping in value as a result of the rate cut, a prediction that ultimately came true a day and a half later. In just 36 hours, it appears the mystery trader made the bet three times, raking in a total of $60 million. Though he may be better known now for his progressive activism, the 82-year-old Soros first garnered fame for shorting the British pound in a $10 billion bet that broke the Bank of England. Soros reaped $1 billion from that 1992 gamble and forced the Bank of England to desperately buy £1 billion and raise interest rates by 2% as more speculators followed Soros and bet against the pound. If this rumor turns out to be true, and I suspect that it is, the move won't have near the same impact as the bet against Britain. No, no. $1 billion is a lot more than $60 million. It's more likely to have psychological influence. But still, 60 million bucks in a little less than 2 or 3 days. What do you think? By the way, I had somebody write me the other day and said, George Soros is dead. Well, hate to tell you this, but the obituary was accidentally published by Reuters last month. He's had major success more recently as well. The yen has declined 18% against the dollar this year, according to Bloomberg. That is where most of the money is being made right now, is shorting the yen. So, lots of interesting stuff. Let me see here. I got a listener who writes in. She has more information about this high-altitude rocket that was launched by NASA, and also some more stuff on, it just keeps coming in. It says violent ionospheric storms can occur in the equatorial F region a few hours after sunset, and if we can better understand what causes these storms, we'll be able to better mitigate the effects on communication and navigation systems. It looks like that's what the NASA experiment was about. The NASA Terrier Improved Orion sounding rocket leaves the launch pad at, looks like, Roy Namur in the Republic of the Marshall Islands. The NASA Terrier Improved Orion sounding rocket is what has left these particles, these high-altitude particles, to try to correct or at least measure the high-altitude winds, which will allow them to make corrections in the GPS satellites. You might know, if you listen to this program often enough, that the GPS satellite system is aging severely. In fact, my high school buddy, Mr. James Helsper, worked at Hughes and was partially responsible, at least the Washington side of it, for getting that system up there in space. Well, that was a long time ago. Those satellites are already about 2 years overdue being replaced, and we are behind schedule. Why are we behind? Well, because we don't have a space shuttle program anymore. I hate to tell you, but that was how we put those things up there in place. A lot of times we launch them up in place with rockets, but they get fine-tuned and placed exactly where they're supposed to go by the space shuttle. So we're way behind replacing those, and so we're having problems keeping the GPS located where it needs to be. She's also sent in some stuff about... it's too much to read. They're having some problems with some infection rates at hospitals. By the way, hospitals are rated on their infection rate. They try to keep it less than 10%. If it gets to 10%, it's a real, real problem. And there's hardly any hospitals that are less than 10% anymore. If you see someone who works at the hospital at the McDonald's or at the gym and they're wearing their scrubs, will you please tell them to leave those scrubs at the hospital and not take those diseases outside the hospital into the community and take them home with them? Just change into street clothes before you leave the hospital. There's a new a CRE virus. It's not good. It looks like the antibiotics we have are not as effective as we hoped they would be. And the doctors may have to resort to using some of the older antibiotics, you know, to try to get in there and be effective against the newer viruses. One of the things the doctors will be asking is, do you want us to give you one of the older antibiotics that could lead to kidney failure and a lifetime of dialysis or amputation? Ann Morrison is the expert that's reporting this. She's quite prolific on several radio programs, so we may have her on this program before long. The country could be entering a period of post-antibiotic era. You know, we've been using them since the 20s, and we're getting to the point where the only bacteria that are alive that can survive are the ones that can withstand the antibiotics. The safer antibiotics that we use today are not as effective against CRE. The hospitals are being sent out a six-step process called Detect and Protect in response to the new CRE threat. Also, a UV ray measurement being taken in Mexico City is now registering 16. So I would not recommend sunbathing in Mexico City. NASA's trying to, NASA blowing a hole in the ionosphere, possibly with the sounding rocket, would do nothing to help our exposure to the UV threat. International Space Station and their team of seven said, Houston, we have a problem. Some of you might be aware of this. The cooling system, which uses ammonium, was nicked by a small pebble and is being ejected into space. You know, ammonium coolers work similar to Freon coolers, except Freon, of course, will never go gaseous in space, too cold, but ammonium will. There is a backup system, and they are out there trying to repair it. It looks like they have done it. They don't have a method to get the seven off the space station in any immediate way. Should they have to evacuate, they can get some of them off, but not all of them. Considering we are moving through this very active fireball meteor place in the universe, a space station may not be, you know, the safest place to be. We have talked about the gravel road that seems to exist at the galactic plane, and that seems to be what we're going through right now, and hence one of the little pesky pebbles in the gravel road nicked a hole in the cooling system. Additions that are being put up, by the way, some of the newer craft produced by Bigelow Industries are inflatable spacecraft. That is to say, they're launched in a collapsed form, and then when they get into space, a small amount of interior gas is injected, and the spacecraft simply inflates into place. And you might think, oh, gee, we're going to send these giant balloons up into space. Not so. These are actually quite thick, multi-layer Kevlar and polymer walls. Not only can they resist the UV better than aluminum, but they can also weather all kinds of meteorite strikes, the little sandy things that strike the space shuttle and different aspects of it at 18,000 miles an hour or so, have almost no effect on a soft, resilient covering on the outside. So it could be that most of our orbiting craft that have people inside, or interplanetary craft with pods or areas for life support, may be inflatable. Get a lot more bang for the cubic inch when you do that. Just a lot of interesting space exploration that other countries are doing, and we're kind of piggybacking along. A lot of the science comes from this country, but we have to piggyback rides with other people because we don't have an active space program, a manned space program anymore. Hopefully that will change in about 33 months. We'll see what happens. I also have a Monsanto update. It's going to last into the next hour, but I want to let you know that the phone lines are now open. Anywhere in North America, if you'd like to reach me here at X Squared Radio, it's 888-429-5471. We're on channel 2 at bbsradio.com. You can also go to x2-radio.com, and I recommend that you do that. Learn a little bit more about the program, and also visit our affiliates. My favorite one that we have on the program right now is the Food Investor. That's one of the best things you can invest in, and you know it. So if you've got a tax refund check coming back, or you've had a bonus check for springtime work coming in, maybe some overtime or an extra Friday a month, you might want to go to the Food Investor and pick up some of this stuff. It is made by my friends Scott and Danny out in Utah, and it is very nutritious, very tasty, and has no preservatives in it. And talk about set it and forget it. You just make your investment in your food, receive it at your home, put it in the backpack by your front door, and forget about it until you need it. And all kinds of situations can occur where you might need it. There might be a tornado, might be a fire, might be a flood or an earthquake, or heaven forbid, some other kind of event that requires you to leave the house for a while, like 2 or 3 days, on foot, on an emergency basis. And unless you are really confident that you, your family, or your friends can really rely on FEMA to bring you the cookies and cocoa and a warm blanket, I highly recommend visiting the Food Investor and getting that in place. It's the best Mother's Day or Father's Day gift you could ever give, is the security that you could walk out of the house and you could survive. Not just survive, you could eat well for 3 days or 4 days or a month. This stuff's lightweight, it's affordable, and delicious. All right. Monsanto update. As you know, we have a new law that's been proposed by the European Commission. Now, we don't think that that's going to have too much of an effect on us, but you watch. You watch, because Monsanto, as you know, is a global company. They have stuff going everywhere. And they've tried to launch things here in this country. But they're not very received very well because they compete against other seed providers in this country, which we also send seed around the world from this country. So they have concentrated in third world countries. They have penetrated and dominated those markets first, bringing their genetically modified organisms into those markets. Why? Because the people have no choice. They have no economic will to be able to resist Monsanto. And so Monsanto has built a huge, huge economic base. And what do they do with that economic base? They pour the money into politics. So this new law proposed by the European Commission would make it illegal, against the law, to grow, reproduce, or trade any vegetable seeds that have not been, quote, tested, approved, and accepted by a new EU bureaucracy named the EU Plant Variety Agency. Dun, dun, dun. Yep. It's called the Plant Reproductive Material Law. And it attempts to put the government in charge of virtually all plants and seeds. Home gardeners who grow their own plants from non-regulated seeds, you got it, would be considered criminals under this law. Oh, you can go ahead and reload your ammunition. That's still legal, but you can't plant your own garden. The draft text of the law, which has already been amended several times due to a huge backlash from gardeners, is viewable. I will send it to you if you write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com. I will send it to you. The law will immediately stop the professional development of vegetable varieties for home gardeners, organic growers, and small-scale market farmers, said Ben Gable, vegetable breeder and director of the Real Seed Catalog. Home gardeners have really different needs. For example, they grow by hand, not machine, and can't or don't want to use such powerful chemical sprays. There's no way to register the varieties suitable for home use as they don't meet the strict criteria of the Plant Variety Agency, which is only concerned about approving the sort of seed used by industrial farmers. Now, this could get big. I mean really big, because all governments are, of course, infatuated with the idea of registering everybody and everything. Title IV registration of varieties in national and union registers is going on right now. Gardeners must also pay fees to the EU, the European Union bureaucracy, for the registration of their seeds. So if you have a seed, you want to register it, you have to pay to register it. Now, here's what the proposed law text actually says, briefly. The competent authorities and the CPVO should charge fees for the processing of applications. The formal and technical examinations, including audits, variety denomination, and the maintenance of the varieties for each year for the duration of the registration. While this law may initially only be targeted at commercial gardeners, it does set a precedent, a legal precedent, to sooner or later go after home gardeners and require them to abide by the same insane regulations. Now, this is clearly an instance of bureaucracy out of control. All this new law does is create a whole new raft of EU civil servants being paid to move mountains of paper around all day while killing off the seed supply to home gardeners and interfering with the right of farmers to grow what they want, or even better, grow what their customers want to eat. It is also very worrying that they have given themselves the power to regulate and license any plant species of any sort at all. in the future. Not just agricultural plants, but grasses, mosses, flowers, trees, anything at all, without having to bring it back to the council for a vote. As a hint of the level of insane bureaucracy that gardeners and vegetable growers will be subjected to under this EU law, I want you to listen closely to this language. Now, you see if you can make sense of this. I'm just doing this to keep you aware, to keep you informed, so that you can make a decision when, and I'm not saying if, when this type of legislation reaches the United States. Trust me, it will. Specific provisions are set out on the registration in the Union Variety Register and will, with regard to the possibility for the applicant to launch an appeal against the CPVO decision. Such provisions are not laid down for the registration in the National Variety Registers because they are subject to national administrative procedures. A new obligation for each national variety examination center to be audited by the CPVO will be introduced with the aim to ensure the quality and harmonization of the variety registration process in the union. The examination center of the professional operators will be audited and approved by the national competent authorities. In case of direct application to the CPVO, it will audit and approve the examination centers it uses for variety examination. Now, that sounds perfectly clear to me, doesn't it, to you? Okay. Now, that language, of course, is Orwellian bureaucratic speak. Okay? That means only one thing. All gardeners should prepare to be subjected to total government insanity over seeds, vegetables, flowers, and home gardens. Well, unfortunately, you can't just read the first five pages that are an executive summary and think you know what this law is about. You just can't do it. You got to read the entire law. We're not going to do it on this program. But as you might suspect, this move is the final solution of, you got it, Monsanto, DuPont, and other seed domination corporations who have long admitted their goal is the complete domination of all seeds and crops grown on the planet, which means the control of the entire planet's food supply. By criminalizing the private growing of vegetables, thereby turning gardeners into criminals, EU bureaucrats can finally hand over full control of the food supply to the most powerful corporation in the world, Monsanto. Nearly all varieties of heirloom vegetable seeds will be criminalized under this proposed EU law. This means the act of saving seeds from one generation to the next, a cornerstone of sustainable living, will become a criminal act. This is the ultimate wish of all governments of all time, to criminalize any act of self-reliance and make the population completely and totally dependent on monopolistic corporations for their very survival. It is the ultimate fascist goal. This is true both in the USA and the EU. This is what governments do. They seize control, one sector at a time, year after year, until you are living as nothing more than a total slave under a globalist dictatorial regime. I don't know if there's anything you can do about it, but you can keep listening to X Squared Radio. We'll keep you informed. Save those seeds. You might have to grow your garden in a basement, but save those seeds. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
I heard there was a were strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew.
Brooks Agnew, and we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. We're so glad that you're able to join us tonight. Our phone number, again, 888-429-5471. Anywhere in North America, anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can reach us, 530-413-9537. If you must duck out, like to go see the convergence between three planets in the sunset sky, you can do so and still stay tuned to the program by dialing 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000. That's our conference line. And then the passcode 769-608 pound. That will allow you to listen to the program on your cell phone, which is kind of a neat feature. One of the neat features that is offered by BBS Radio. I can tell you that we have a great, great privilege of being part of the BBS Radio stable of hosts. We've been here now 8 years, and we're on every Sunday evening between 8 and 11 here at X Squared Radio. But BBS Radio is now arguably the number one offerer of live content on the web of any network on earth. You're here. You're in the right place. Just put us on your favorite bookmark, because anytime, almost night or day, any day of the week, you can tune into BBS Radio and get great live content. Tune into Channel 2, which is where we are in the evenings. You can also go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and sign up for our archives. It helps us keep the lights on, helps us pay our bills at for airtime and other things. And please visit our affiliates like the Food Investor and make a small purchase, get a high-value product, and help us keep the lights on as well. Now, we were finishing up with a Monsanto alert, a really genetically modified organisms alert in the last hour. You know, there is a vast underground network, and you knew this was going to happen. 240 organizations from 40 European countries have written an open letter appealing to Brussels bureaucrats to stop this insanity of this incredible overreaching law that has been enacted. It's completely Orwellian doublespeak. And the name of this law is, well, it's under Title 4 of the proposed EU law. It is called the, it's for the registration of seeds. And so it's called the, they've created a new bureaucracy called the European Union Plant Variety Agency. Now that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? It's, the law is called the Plant Reproductive Material Law. Now, it's just going in the EU right now. I'm sure there are a lot of home gardens in the EU. But if you do have a home garden and you're not using the approved seeds, you're a criminal. You're a criminal. Seeds are about to become contraband. So if you have been making your own seeds, you've been saving a little corn, saving a little bit of those little lettuce seeds that you get, or you know, a strain of broccoli that you like or whatever, those seeds are now contraband. Anyone who grows their own food is about to be targeted. The governments of the world, conspiring with corporations like Monsanto, do not want any individual to be able to grow their own food. As I said before, this is about the total dominion of the food supply and the criminalization of gardeners. And this is what big government always does. All governments inherently seek total control over the lives of everyone. And if you don't set boundaries and limits for government, they're going to stop being your governor and they're going to start being your ruler. Now, a lot of people ask me, you know, who is Monsanto? What are they all about? What is what they have to say in their words? And I want to play this for you. This is, and I hope this link works. I was having a little problem with these working last week. This is off Monsanto's website under the About Us link. I just want to play it for you. I just want you to listen to it. Just sit back, listen to them, and then I will, you know, try to explain to you what they're really trying to say. Here we go. Just listen up.
When you close your eyes and visualize our planet, what do you see? An orb hanging in the blackness of space? A hand-drawn map elegantly defining the line between land and sea? Now, go outside and stand barefoot in the grass. Look around. Breathe the air. Feel the planet move beneath you. What you're feeling is a living planet. What you're feeling is our home. But the planet feels us too. It feels the increasing weight of us and the stress of supporting that weight. You may not realize that because home may look fine where you're standing now. But stand in the congested streets of a developing country and you'll see millions of people struggling to feed themselves. Stand in the Amazon or the Arctic, you'll see ancient rainforests and majestic shelves of ice disappearing. and stand in one of the many isolated villages around the world. And you'll see farmers with little access to technology or markets, unable to pull themselves out of poverty. These global challenges are complex, and there are no easy answers. But one thing is clear. Agricultural innovation holds a key solution, and we pledge to do our part. We're Monsanto, and we're working with farmers and partners worldwide to realize a vision for sustainable agriculture. It's a vision that strives to meet the needs of a rapidly growing population, to protect and preserve this planet we all call home, and to help improve lives everywhere. We're working with farmers to increase what they can grow on an acre of land, and we're making great progress. We're working to reduce the amount of land, water, and energy they'll need to grow those crops. And we're working to improve lives in the process by harnessing innovative technology to give growers better tools so they can provide for their families, their communities, and people around the world. Because when farmers prosper, so many more will also prosper. Through healthier diets, greater educational opportunities, and brighter economic futures. Agriculture has always had a role in shaping the future of humanity. And we know it will take more than one company to shape the future of agriculture. So whatever the world looks like where you stand, the truth is, we're all in this together. And we believe, working together, we can create a brighter, sustainable world for all of us. That's the world we visualize at Monsanto. And we're working every day to make it reality.
All right. So you hear the Monsanto, I'm going to call it advertisement, but it really is propaganda, where they are working with third world countries where yields are low, rainfall is irregular, soils have been planted over and over and over again without the benefit of rotation crops, fertilizers are expensive, pests are rampant, and weeds. And so Monsanto creates a seed that is Roundup ready. I don't know if you know what that means, but Roundup is an herbicide. It kills everything except for the plants that are Roundup ready. Now, what Monsanto has done is they have genetically modified the seed itself so that the plant is immune to the chemical that's being poured on everything around it. So only the plant that they want to draw nutrients from the soil is able to draw nutrients from the soil. So the fact that they've also put markers in these genetics to make the plants more resistant to insects. Now, they can use insecticides on the plants, but then what that really does is kill the natural balance of insects and predators on insects in a region. And so it prepares the region for a plague of insects that are not covered under the broad spectrum pesticide. You've heard that twice now, not once, but twice, locusts have attacked and just about cleaned out the crops in some of these third world countries. It's because this ecological balance keeps getting upset by wiping out all of the food supply for some of the predator insects that actually take care of the food insects, the ones that actually attack the food. So really smart farmers, what they're doing is they're introducing spiders and they're introducing wasps and things like that into the ecosystem so that they can prey on the insects that are actually eating the crops. And it's a much more balanced and sustainable way of doing things. Now, the interesting thing about this Monsanto story, the thing that's really making it critical, is that anonymously added to a recent budget bill. Now, we're not talking about the European budget bill. We're talking about the U.S. budget bill. The controversial rider would protect U.S. biotech companies such as Monsanto from litigation if their GMO seeds turn out to be dangerous. Well, everybody outside of Washington is throwing their arms up with a big warning sign saying, wait a minute, hold on a second. Are we talking about the Food and Drug Administration? Are we talking about the administration that won't allow beneficial curing drugs or treatments to reach the market because they have to thoroughly test them to see if there's any side effects? Are we talking about the same company that makes drug providers run all those side effects, you know, on TV, like ask your doctor about this drug? And don't forget, if you have thoughts of suicide or a runny nose, to let your doctor know and we'll stop it immediately. Well, since when did patients start going to their doctors to try to sell the doctor on a drug that they want to take? Well, since the rules changed, of course. So if this is the same Food and Drug Administration, the same FDA, why would they let a company introduce a seed that turns out to be dangerous? Don't they test it? Don't they do clinical tests with it? Don't they run these through several generations to make sure people's livers will survive, to make sure their intestines can digest the stuff, to make sure that all the bugs that are in the human gut can actually process this stuff? Do they make sure that all the insects that fly around nature, the bees and the butterflies and the moths and whatever, that they can land on these plants, drink from the nectar, spread pollen from one place to another without being adversely affected? Don't they test this stuff? Well, evidently not well enough, because litigation is harsh in their gig. Anger over the Monsanto Protection Act is growing like an herbicide-resistant weed, fueled by the news the rider was anonymously added to a U.S. budget bill in an apparent favor, a backdoor favor, to biotech firms. Well, I wonder why that was done. The measure has made unlikely allies of Tea Party and environmental groups. Can you believe it? They're working together. Inspired more than 250,000 people to sign a petition opposing this act, and even prompted the head of the Senate Appropriations Committee to retroactively disavow it. Yeah, we caught you. But what exactly is the Monsanto Protection Act? Why is it causing such an uproar? Well, first, it isn't actually called the Monsanto Protection Act. We just call it that because that's who benefits from it the most. Its more formal name is Section 735 of the Consolidated and Further Continuing Appropriations Act 2013, or H.R. 933, an appropriations bill that President Obama signed into law last week. The bill averted a government shutdown, but many lawmakers were reportedly unaware of Section 735's existence. Yeah, the budget bill was there because the Senate has not completed a budget, not one that makes sense, and Obama has never introduced a budget that anyone has voted for, Democrat or Republican. So they had to sign a bill to kind of keep the lights on, you know, a continuing kind of budget. And snuck into that bill was H.R. 933, which is also known as Section 735. The bill, in fact, rather than undergoing a formal committee hearing, this rider was anonymously inserted, not by your congressman or my congressman or your senator or my senator. Nobody in the 535, the gang of 535, that would be 100 senators and 435 congressmen, is taking credit for this. Nobody wants their name on it. In other words, we don't have a McCain-Feingold, a Dodd-Frank, a Sarbanes-Oxley. No, there's no names on this bill. It's anonymous. It wound its way through Congress, sparking accusations of opacity, collusion, corruption, and its origins still remain hazy. But Senator Roy Blunt, Republican from Missouri, has since told Politico he worked with Monsanto to secure the rider. This all can be boiled down to a single common phrase, a special interest loophole, and a doozy at that. This is a situation in which a company is given the ability to ignore court orders and what boils down to a deregulation scheme for a particular set of industries. Environmentalists and food safety advocates have voiced similar concerns. And interestingly enough, even when the voters, the people that are actually going to be eating this food, feeding it to their kids and their babies, even when they were given the opportunity to put a label, just a simple label on the food, just on the package of the food that says this food contains genetically modified organisms, guess what they said? We don't want to know. Don't put the label on there. Just let them put it in there. We don't care. We're hungry. We just want the potatoes. We just want the corn. We just want the soybeans. We just want the bread. We don't want to know. We don't want to know. The voters of California voted that label down. They don't want to know. The Center for Food Safety recently called the writer an unprecedented attack on U.S. judicial review of agency actions and a major violation of the separation of powers. That's exactly what we have been talking about here on X Squared Radio for a year. It's exactly the language in the blockbuster book Alienated Nation, that the separation of powers is done. The president, the executive branch, by itself is in direct control of all the agencies. That's the Food and Drug Administration. That's Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. That's the Department of Transportation. That's the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the IRS, and the list goes on and on and on. Why? Because the president's, quote, cabinet is appointed by the president. The cabinet is made up of secretaries. The secretaries interpret and produce guidelines and final rules for the regulations that are actually where the rubber meets the road for the laws that Congress passes. Congress passes a law, and then it's up to the agencies to create a bank of regulations to make that law work. But here's the catch. You have no representation in that agency. You don't have a representative. There is no republic. And your congressman can't speak to that agency. It's illegal. It is against the law for your congressman to speak to that regulatory body. They can't do it. And those regulations that are written have the force of law. That means that they can tax you, they can fine you, they can jail you, they can seize your property, they can block you from doing business, they can interfere with your commerce, interstate, intrastate, or internationally. And you have no representation in that organization. That, my friends, is taxation without representation. That is a major violation of the separation of powers. At issue with respect to this are genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, created by Monsanto and other biotech firms. While there's no hard evidence that GMOs can harm humans, oh, I beg to differ with that, some worry about undiscovered health risks and the possibility of man-made genes spreading to wild plants, potentially wreaking ecological havoc. Supporters of the Monsanto Protection Act, who prefer to call it the Farmer Assurance Provision, say it simply aims to prevent activists from using the court system to make farmers scrap or destroy their genetically modified crops. Well, sounds reasonable to me. Torch that stuff. If that corn turns out to be dangerous, it's killing our bees, or it's producing tumors in the gut of cows, or it is somehow creating a layer of belly fat or high blood pressure in humans that now has to be treated with pharmaceuticals to keep us alive, burn that stuff. Absolutely. Sue the crap out of them. Let's pour a bunch of gas on that and burn it. As we understand it, the point of the Farmer Assurance Provision is to strike a careful balance, allowing farmers to continue to plant and cultivate their crops subject to appropriate environmental safeguards, while the USDA, also a government agency, the USDA conducts any necessary further environmental reviews. And most of the USDA people couldn't find their own bumper with a flashlight in both hands. Critics say Congress caved to the biotech lobby, which they see as especially galling given the success of industry stalwart Monsanto. Just this week, for example, Monsanto reported its net sales rose 15% to $5.5 billion, not for the year, just in the second quarter. And the company raised its full-year profit forecast by 10 cents a share. That's unbelievable. It raised its full-year profit forecast by 10 cents a share. I mean, come on, people. They've got a great portfolio. The seeds and genomics business is performing quite well. Nonetheless, H.R. 933 Rider essentially grants Monsanto temporary immunity from legal challenges to the safety of its seeds, setting what Siggins and other observers have called a dangerous precedent. It is not the purview of Tea Party patriots to comment on the merits of GMOs. That is a discussion for debate for experts and activists within that field. From the perspective of citizens like you, who want open, transparent government that serves the people, however, the so-called Monsanto Protection Act is one heck of a special interest loophole for friends of Congress. Oh, and I mean very good friends. You probably don't know this, but the number one Ferrari dealership in the entire nation, Washington, D.C. The number one Lamborghini and Maserati dealerships, you guessed it, Washington, D.C. Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, and even Rolls-Royce, you got it, Washington, D.C. Special interests is not a little bit of money. It's big money. And these guys want this money. They want this power over your food supply in one generation. Your kids, your grandkids, be hanged. Here's what it says. In the event that a determination of non-regulated status made pursuant to Section 411 of the Plant Protection Act or has been invalidated or vacated, the Secretary of Agriculture, there's that secretary again. By the way, who appoints the Secretary of Agriculture? That's right, the president does. Who does the secretary answer to? That's exactly right, the president. So let's just say it the way it really is. The president shall, notwithstanding any other provision of law, upon request by a farmer, grower, farm operator, or producer, immediately grant temporary permit or temporary deregulation in part, subject to necessary and appropriate conditions consistent with Section 411A or 412C of the Plant Protection Act, which interim conditions shall authorize the movement, introduction, continued cultivation, commercialization, and other specifically enumerated activities and requirements, including measures designed to mitigate or minimize potential adverse environmental effects, if any, relevant to the president's evaluation of the petition for non-regulated status, while ensuring that growers or other users are able to move, plant, cultivate, blah, blah, blah. That all such conditions shall be applicable only for the interim period necessary for the president to complete any required analysis or consultations related to the petition for non-regulated status. In other words, there's nothing anyone can do to stop that farmer from using that seed. If that farmer, however, wants to burn his seed, nobody can stop him. The Plant Protection Act referenced in the rider is a 2000 law regulating plant pests, noxious weeds, and biological control organisms. Senator Barbara Mikulski, Democrat from Maryland, took some early blame for the rider, including from the Center for Food Safety. In this hidden backroom deal, Senator Mikulski turned her back on consumer, environmental, and farmer protection in favor of corporate welfare for biotech companies like Monsanto. This abuse of power is not the kind of leadership the public has come to expect from Senator Mikulski or the Democrat majority in the Senate. But several days later, Mikulski issued a press release distancing herself from the measure. Senator Mikulski understands the anger over this provision. She didn't put the language in the bill and doesn't support it either, the statement said. It was originally part of the Agricultural Appropriations Bill that the House Appropriations Committee reported in June of 2012, and it became part of the House-Senate agreement completed in the fall of 2012. So you can see that this is just a whole lot of two-stepping. Blunt says he was able to introduce the rider thanks partly to Mikulski's predecessor on the committee, the late Senator Daniel Inouye, a Democrat from Hawaii. Inouye was sympathetic given Monsanto's large seed operations in Hawaii. As much controversy as the provision has generated, though, it has a relatively short shelf life. Unless it's renewed by Congress this year, 2013, and the Senate Appropriations Chairwoman is now on record saying she opposes it, the Monsanto Protection Act is slated to expire after 6 months when the fiscal year ends on September 30th. Let me tell you something, Earth Explorers. We will be right here on September 30th to make sure that it does that. If it doesn't, we'll be right back on the radio talking about it. So what's really going on here? The fascism of food supply. Because, you know, Russia, 60% of the fresh produce in Russia comes from home gardens. When times get hard in the United States, people plow up that nice lawn in the back and they plant a garden. I had a garden with my kids and we had fresh tomatoes and peppers and we often grew our own potatoes. And we tried to grow lettuce, but we ended up growing rabbits instead. But we grew corn and other things and we ate it right out of our garden. Did we need to survive? No, not really. But at the end of the day, folks, I wasn't raising a garden. I was raising kids. So contrary to popular opinion, the corporatization of the American food system is not being driven by you. It's certainly not being driven by me. You're not out there saying, oh, we want genetically modified organisms. We want to make sure that we have greater yield of corn or wheat or whatever. You're not the ones out there driving it. And that's clearly what's wrong with the system. As opposed to, you know, the electric vehicle business, we have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of customers coming to us wanting our electric vehicles. It's being driven by consumer pressure. It's being driven by a demand in the marketplace. Government isn't pushing it. Far from it. But in this case, the conditions necessary for markets to reflect the real food preferences of consumers, they don't exist anymore. If a market is to be responsive to consumers' needs and preferences, there also has to be many buyers and sellers. That any one buyer or seller could go out of business or double production with no noticeable effect on product availability or price. That's why we have so many markets. That's why there are so many stores to shop from. You can stop at a roadside market. You can buy it from, you know, Vons or Alpha Beta or you can buy it from Harris Teeter or, you know, Piggly Wiggly or Red Owl. You can buy food from almost anywhere. And those markets compete against one another. The farmers supply those different stores. And that's the way it should be. The best competition creates the best product. It's a better looking fruit or vegetable. It lasts better. It's more nutritious. It's bigger. It's fatter. Its color is better. It's delivered fresher. But if one of those farmers goes out of business or one of those markets goes out of business, like you remember Winn-Dixie went out of business a few years back, did it stop the food supply to your dinner table? No, it didn't, because we had variety. We had choice. So we had a double protection in that sense. But in such markets, costs of producing different foods would be accurately reflected in retail food prices because sellers would have no ability to retain excess profits. It would also be relatively easy for new sellers to bring new and better products into such markets. Thus, sellers would not be able to limit the variety of foods available to their customers. Well, this is the exact opposite of that. This is what fascism does. Food markets in the U.S. have not been economically competitive for decades. For example, the Packers' Consent Decree of 1920 was an effort to break up a shared monopoly that existed in meatpacking at that time. The Packers and the Stockyards Act of 1921 was an attempt to prevent the reconcentration of corporate power in the meatpacking industry. Obviously, it didn't work, as the concentration of market power in meatpacking today is far greater than in 1920. Market economies have a natural tendency to evolve toward an ever greater concentration of economic power. A primary economic function of government is to maintain competition so the markets will bring forth the right products to serve the best interests of society. That's why the federal government should exist. So there are lots of states, lots of supplies, lots of competition, not just cheap products. The U.S. government has not only failed to maintain free markets, it has actually promoted the industrialization of agriculture and the consequent corporate consolidation of the food system. It's done the exact opposite of what we have chartered federal government to do. The federal government has only recently given in to persistent pressures to enforce the provisions of the Packers and Stockyard Act of 1921. It remains to be seen how effective these belated efforts may be in restoring some sense of competition. What, you haven't noticed the high price of beef lately? You haven't noticed the high price of pork? Or how chicken has gone up almost 300% in the last 6 years? You haven't noticed that? So that 99 cent per pound chicken that you used to buy 4 or 5 years ago, that's now $3.99 a pound. You don't mind that? You don't mind paying $6.95 a pound for a steak? You don't mind paying, $6 or $7 or $8 a pound for premium cuts of meat? Well, I got news for you. That's where it comes from, the corporatization of the food supply. Evidence of corporate influence on government farm and food policy is pervasive and publicly available. If you want to find out about it, trust me, there are so many Ferraris and Rolls Royces running around Washington, D.C., paid for by food lobbies, seed lobbies, fertilizers, all kinds of stuff. Political contributions from agribusiness amounted to more than $65 million during this 2008 federal election cycle, going to candidates of both parties. The top contributors were corporations involved in production and processing of sugar, tobacco, dairy products. All are heavily dependent on government farm programs. Sugar subsidies are insane. Bananas, tobacco, wheat. The CRP system is rife with corruption. The top contributors by category were agricultural services and products, $9.7 million. Food processing and sales, $7.4 million. Crop production, basic processing, $6 million. Tobacco, $4.8 million. Are you believing this? After a $1 billion settlement with Philip Morris and other tobacco suppliers, we are still subsidizing tobacco. Not surprisingly, the top recipient of agribusiness lobby money among U.S. House candidates, the list is right here. Colin Peterson, Democrat from Minnesota, Chair of House Agricultural Committee. Blanche Lincoln, Republican from Arkansas, ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee, was the top recipient among U.S. Senate candidates. Do you think it's any coincidence that both of these people had ranking positions, chairman and ranking member positions on agricultural committees in the Congress and the Senate? Campaign contributions represent only the tip of the iceberg of corporate influence. Monsanto, who holds patents on 80% of all genetically modified seeds, spent almost $9 million lobbying just in year 2009. And that was an off election year for national politics. ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, a giant grain company, also involved in ethanol production, chipped in another $1.2 million. Cargill, a multinational grain company, came up with another $1.7 million. Believe me, lobbying is everyday business for corporations, big business for agribusiness in Washington, D.C. And these corporations are not limited to for-profit businesses. The essence of corporatism is the separation of decision-making from the personal responsibilities of ownership or membership. Many political action groups, including labor unions and environmental organizations, are corporate, actually, in the sense that their lobbyists may or may not accurately represent the core values of their individual members. We see that all the time with the American labor unions pumping millions and millions of dollars into candidates that the rank-and-file members of the union do not support. The American Farm Bureau Federation, those of you in the Midwest and South know who they are. They are the most powerful lobbyist in D.C. It is a prime example of an organization that clearly misrepresents the basic values of its membership when it claims to speak for agriculture. In fact, a large portion of its members are not farmers at all, many being urban residents who become members by virtue of taking out Farm Bureau insurance policies. We had Farm Bureau insurance for 18 years. The Farm Bureau reported spending $4.5 million per year during the debates leading up to the 2001 Farm Bill. Survival and growth are prerequisite for corporate success, regardless of the mission, and thus becomes the top priority of corporate policies. In other words, these giant, mega-billion-dollar corporations buy politicians. They buy them. So it's virtually impossible to come up with any meaningful estimate of the total political influence of such groups, as they all have politically active state-level organizations that support their national organizations. Restraints on corporate lobbying at state and local levels are practically non-existent. In Missouri, for example, there's not a single piece of legislation that passes out of agricultural committees and onto the assembly floor for debate unless it has first been approved by lobbyists for Missouri Farm Bureau and Missouri Ag Industries, the agribusiness lobby. In such states, urban legislators never have an opportunity to vote on legislation that might challenge the industrialization of agriculture or corporate control of the food system. That, my friends, is fascism at its best. Government farm subsidies obviously are not all allocated among farmers with any sense of equity or justice at all. The USDA statistics for 1995 to 2009, a 14-year period, indicate that 74% of total government payments went to the largest 10% of recipients. In general, to those with the largest farming operations. Small farmers, mid-sized farmers, forget about it. The 80% of recipients receiving the smallest government checks received only 12% of the total government money, leaving 14% of payments for the remaining 10% of recipients. It isn't because they know how to write better grants, people. It's because they don't know how to write checks to politicians. As a consequence of farm politics, some commodities are subsidized more heavily than others. You have fruit vegetable crop that ranks among the top 20 in subsidies, apples, corn, wheat, cotton, rice, and soybeans. It's as if the citizens of the country were bushels of corn, soybeans, wheat, or rice rather than people who own the land, tended the crops, and eat the food. One bushel, one vote. That, my friends, is not constitutional. More than half of all government farm subsidies went to 10 states, Texas, Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, Minnesota, North Dakota, Nebraska, California, South Dakota, and Missouri. During 2009, 60% of farm subsidies went to states represented by senators serving on a Senate Agricultural Committee. And 37% of the subsidies went to states represented on the House Agricultural Committee. Four of the top five congressional districts receive agricultural subsidies were states represented on the House Agricultural Committee. That's like saying four out of five dentists recommend. Well, this is four out of five congressional districts that received money from taxpayers. They serve on the House Agricultural Committee. In many cases, if not most, politicians put the economic interests of corporate lobbyists ahead of the public interests of society in general. And keep in mind, even though these things go through congressional and senatorial committees, they are governed by the secretaries. They are ruled over by the secretaries, and the secretaries work for the president. Trust me, I could trace the money for you if you want me to, but I don't think you want me to. Hundreds of millions of dollars of that money ends up in the administration to maintain power in Washington. All right, let's do a drone wars update. Kind of an interesting spring. Some amazing stuff happening. Amazing stuff. You know that we have this whole thing that happened in Benghazi, right? No. Benghazi did not star in a doctor's program in the 60s. That would be Ben Gazzara. Benghazi is a city in Libya. It's where we had an embassy. That's where American diplomats serve, and they try to serve American interests in those countries. Keep us aware. What's going on? Help us make deals. Help us keep peace. That kind of stuff. Well, Benghazi, September 11th of last year. Gee, that's kind of a coincidental date. Don't you think that government would have a little bit of wherewithal to maybe beef up the security in those areas? But no, they didn't. And by the way, many, many emails were written. Many phone calls were made. Hey, we need some more security. We have some bad guys that have been flying into town here for 4 or 5 weeks. Out-of-towners, we happen to know that they're mercenaries, and I think they're gearing up for something. We'd like to have a couple of extra SEALs, a couple extra security guards, maybe a little extra fencing. No. And it wasn't that they didn't have the money. They did, because there was something else going on. Well, I'm going to play a little audio clip for you. I hope it comes through. I think the last one came through okay. This is a campaign ad that was run in the primaries when Obama was running for president. And I'm going to add some words to it that make it just a little bit more effective. The first part of it is from a McCain ad, and the second part is from Hillary's testimony. So here we go. I want you to listen to this. It's not very long, just a couple of minutes, but see if you can listen to this. Here we go.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world. It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. Who do you want answering the phone?
We were misled that there were supposedly protests and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But the American
people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
So, anyway, that's. I just want to keep you informed. I didn't make any of that up. Those are real words that really took place. Just keeps you aware. Remember that you heard this here, okay? Yes, I put the two pieces together because I want you to understand that it's important. When that 3 a.m. phone rings, you want somebody that is not going to say, stand down. You don't want somebody telling your military leaders, you stand down. You don't go protect our people. You don't want that person answering the phone. Unless there is a true reporter in the mainstream media who will find out who gave the repeated orders to stand down, orders that left American diplomats and servicemen stranded in an unarmed compound in a war zone, Hillary Clinton will be our next president. I just want that to sink in a little bit. The media must provide Americans with enough information about the Benghazi facts that the president and the secretary of state gave the orders to let Ambassador Stevens die before he had a chance to blow the stolen Libyan missile transfer deal made with Turkey. And then conspired to cover up those orders by lying to Congress. The American voter will be fooled into electing a fascist regime to power. It's already happening. It's already happening before our very eyes. And I don't think there's anything anybody can do about it. Now, I want to help you connect some dots here. This is the latest announcement. We're talking about the drone wars update. The latest announcement is that a newly designed Chinese drone called the Sharp Sword is ready for its first flight test after completing its taxi test last December at an unknown airfield in the southeastern province of Jiangxi, reports Duowei News, an outlet operated by overseas Chinese. Now, designed jointly by the Hongdu Aviation Industry Group and Shenyang Aviation Corporation, the Li Jian, which is translated sharp sword, is China's first stealth drone and the third in the world after the X-47 designed by the United States and France's and Yuron. The Li Jian program was launched in 2009 and the drone's ground test was conducted on December 13th of last year. China Aviation News reports that the Li Jian is now ready for flight testing. The drone is set to be used by the PLA Air Force and Navy Air Force for combat missions, but also for tracking and reconnaissance purposes. The prototype means China is ahead of several nations in the development of stealth drones, including Britain, Russia, India, Sweden, Italy, Iran, and Israel. Can you believe it? Israel, which also have their own stealth UAV programs. Now, I happen to know for a fact, because I have an insider, that the Israelis are manufacturing drones inside the United States. Yes, there is a drone plant in Mississippi that makes drones inside the United States. I don't think this reporter knows what he's talking about, because I look at the pictures of this new Chinese design and something looks very familiar about it. I mean, it looks so familiar. No, it's not the Jetsons car. On December 4th, 2011, an American Lockheed Martin RQ-170, you remember, don't you? The Sentinel. It's an unmanned aerial vehicle, stealth drone, was captured by Iranian forces near the city of Kashmir in northeastern Iran. The Iranian government announced that the UAV was brought down by its cyber warfare unit, which commandeered the aircraft and landed it safely after initial reports from Western news sources inaccurately claimed that it had been shot down. Come on. You saw it. I saw it. We reported it right here on X Squared Radio. The RQ-170 didn't have a scratch on it. Now, it had kind of a skirt around the landing gear, and I think maybe that's because the guy or kid who grabbed the video game control and actually let that that drone land on the airport. It didn't land on the desert floor. They flew it back and landed it. Might have had a little rough landing, so it might have had a little problem with the landing gear. But there wasn't a mark on that thing. Now, the interesting thing about it is the way the wings are shaped and the way the, you know, angles are and the way the instruments sort of look out of a window in the front of the unit. I hate to tell you this, folks, but this Legion, it's an RQ-170 Sentinel drone made right here by American Lockheed Martin. So the United States government's claims that the UAV malfunctioned and crashed. We now know that's a lie because we saw the footage for ourselves. The government of Iran announced that the aircraft was brought down by its cyber warfare unit and brought down with minimum damage, and they proved it by showing it on live TV. They said the aircraft was detected in Iranian airspace some 225 kilometers from the border with Afghanistan. Now, that doesn't mean that they picked it up on radar. It could be very stealth relative to radar, but I think it was flying during the daytime. And it's a funny thing about aircraft flying in the daytime. They leave a shadow on the ground. So what the Iranians do is they just fly a Piper Cub up about 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and they watch the ground. And when they see a shadow going across the ground, they simply look up. And guess what? There's the drone. So the question up across everybody's mind is, how did that happen? How did that happen? The government of the United States initially claimed that its forces in Afghanistan had lost control of a UAV on 4 December 2011, and that there was a possibility that this is the vehicle that crashed near Kashmir. But it didn't crash. According to unnamed U.S. officials, a U.S. UAV operated by the Central Intelligence Agency was flying on the Afghan side of the Afghan-Iran border when its operators lost control of the vehicle. But wait. Didn't we just read that it was in Iranian airspace, 225 kilometers, which is about 140 miles from the border with Afghanistan? Who do you think is telling the truth? That's what I thought. I don't have to run an election on this or a vote or a survey. I know exactly what you mean. There have been reports that foreign officials and American experts who have been briefed on the effort state that the crashed UAV was taking part in routine surveillance of Iranian nuclear facilities near or inside Iranian airspace. The truth is that nearly 100% of the chips, not potato chips, the microchips used in these navigation and flight control systems, they're made in China. Silicon Valley doesn't make these chips anymore, folks, although the original ideas came from, well, Chinese scientists working in California. Yes, some of them have become citizens, but nearly all of them came to the U.S. under the H-1B visa, the genius visa, to study. Inside the firmware of the chip, not the software, this is the firmware that makes the chip function. Inside the firmware of these chips is a back door. If you know where the back door is, you simply waltz in and take control of that circuit. The flight controls could be seized, stabilized, and the craft could be easily landed by the average video game player. That is exactly what happened. It did not crash. How do we know this? Because that drone didn't end up in a pile of titanium in the middle of the Iranian desert. It ended up in China, where it is now the model for the Lijian drone. The drone appeared to be largely intact, except for the possible minor visible damage on its left wing and some damage to the landing gear, which was photoshopped out with a curtain around them when they took pictures for the American press. Dan looks like Gore, analysis at the Lexington Institute, stated the largely intact airframe ruled out the possibility of an engine or navigational malfunction. Either this was a cyber electronic warfare attack system that brought the system down, or it was a glitch in the command and control system. However, some U.S. officials state the drone broke into three pieces during impact. They claim that it was reassembled for display purposes and was painted by Iran to hide the damage. Obviously, that was not the case. They lied again. As the full memory of the drone was decrypted, we have seen a video of that as it was safely landed in Iran. And the new sharp sword in China, the Lijian, looks almost exactly like the RQ-170 drone. So, the Department of Defense released a statement acknowledging that it had lost control of a UAV during the previous week, back in December of 2011, claiming that it was flying a mission over western Afghanistan, a lie, when control was lost. The statement did not specify the model of the aircraft. The U.S. government also stated that it was still investigating the cause of the loss. I just told you what the cause of the loss is. A Christian Science Monitor article relates an Iranian engineer's assertion that the drone was captured by jamming both satellite and land-originated control signals, followed up by a GPS spoofing attack that fed the UAV false GPS data to make it land in Iran at what the drone thought was its home base in Afghanistan. Stephen Trimble from Flight Global assumes UAV guidance could be targeted by radar jamming and deception systems supplied to Iran by Russia. In an interview for Nova, U.S. retired Lieutenant General David Deptula also said there was a problem with the aircraft and it landed in an area it wasn't supposed to land. American aeronautical engineers dispute this, pointing out that that as is the case with the MQ-1 Predator or the MQ-9 Reaper and the Tomahawk missile, GPS is not the primary navigation sensor for the RQ-170. The vehicle gets its flight path orders from an inertial navigation system that's like a gyroscope. Inertial navigation continues to be used on military aircraft despite the advent of GPS because GPS signal jamming and spoofing are relatively simple operations. All you need is just a competitive signal that goes up there and tells the airplane that it's in a different place. So you could see this is fun and games. This is just fun and games. This is what we're seeing in the drone wars out there. Okay, this is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. I've got a lot more to go. The rest of this stuff is going to be very hot to handle, so you might want to just cinch up that seatbelt just a little bit. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you. Squared Radio. Just wanted to let you know we're not changing who we are either. I recommend that you don't as well. Welcome back to the third and final hour of X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Just to wrap up the drone wars update, interesting stuff out there in the news. Here in the United States, as we are now one nation under surveillance, if you don't believe me, just drive around your town and look at the surveillance cameras. Drive out on the freeway and see the standalone cameras out there on the freeway. Yeah, they're logging your speed. They can also read your license plate number, and they can put it in a database so they can follow you pretty much anywhere that you go. That doesn't mean that they will do it, but if you do something wrong and your vehicle could be traced at the point of what we call destination or point of perpetration, they'll follow that all the way back to where you came from. In just a few minutes, though, they'll have you rousted. Well, there's a mystery going on. And this is in Quincy, Massachusetts. People want to know who is flying around the city from dusk to dawn for the past 10 days or so. One resident in Wollaston says it's frightening. It's not just weird, but it's frightening. Every night for the past 2 weeks, residents have spotted a low-flying aircraft doing routes over the city. WBZ has learned that the FAA knows what's going on, but the agency isn't telling. One resident told WBZ, "I mean, it's strange. I don't know if they're looking for somebody. I have no idea." It's not the state or the local police doing the flying. They've been quizzed out about that. They have no idea. The FAA is giving out little information, even to city officials. I've got a clip here I want to play, and I think this is going to be pretty typical of what you see. Now, they have said that it is not a drone. It is a manned aircraft, and it is authorized. And the interesting thing is this aircraft does not appear to be flying when it's cloudy or overcast. It only takes to the skies on starlit nights. Now, what do you think's going on out there? Listen up. Here we go.
Real mystery in Quincy. Every night for nearly the past 2 weeks, residents have spotted a low-flying aircraft doing loops over the city. As Bill Shields shows us, the FAA knows what's going on, but the agency isn't telling.
It's frightening. It's more than weird. It's frightening.
That's what a lot of people in Quincy are feeling right now. For the past 10 days or so, an airplane has been buzzing around the city from dusk to dawn, flying low and slow. And
I really don't like the quality of this, so I'm going to stop it.
I mean, it is strange. I don't know if they're looking for somebody or...
Yeah, I'm just going to stop it because the quality is really bad. The point that I'm trying to make here is that this town, this area, is under surveillance. But it doesn't appear that they're looking down. It appears that they're looking up. They're looking for something else that's flying over Quincy, Massachusetts. Pretty interesting, huh? Just some crazy stuff going on out there. We might have a little UFO action going on here. One of my listeners writes in, "I think the aircraft is missioned to do a fact-finding mission. What do you think?" Yes, I agree, but fact-finding of what? If it's a little single-engine craft flying around up there, you know, they might have night vision goggles on flying around, but you don't need starlit skies to look around with night vision goggles. You can look down on the ground and track things that way. It doesn't appear that it has a searchlight going down on the ground at all. It doesn't appear that it's working with law enforcement, because if it was, the mayor would know about it, wouldn't he? Because he's in charge of the police. But if he's looking up, if this plane is flying in such a way that it has a view of the horizon, a little better perspective, where it's, you know, looking for something other than that, that could be interesting too. So here's my suggestion. If you live in Quincy and you're listening to this program, if you have a standard digital camera. Sometimes your phones will do this too. Put it on night vision. Wait till that plane comes over and film it and get me the N number off that plane. The N number, it starts with the letter N. Every single aircraft that takes off or lands in the United States of America has to have an N number. Now, I know. You see planes coming in from other countries, Mexico, Canada, Europe, China, whatever. They land in the U.S., but they don't go anywhere. They turn right around and leave the U.S. And I said, in order to take off and land inside the United States, you must have an N number on that plane. Every plane has it. So, if you can get your night vision out and you can film this plane, you can find out in just a few minutes who owns that plane. And then you'll know what's going on. It's sort of like running a license plate number on a car. Once they hear that number's been run, you're not going to see that airplane up there anymore. My listener writes, I think they also wanted to find out how long it would take the people to alert the authorities and then see how long the authorities would take to notify the national authorities. That's actually a very good observation. It's sort of like, hey, let's go harass this little town flying at night, and let's see how long it takes for the news to pick it up. Let's see how long it takes for the people to complain to the FAA. Well, that's a good observation, but they've been complaining for a couple of weeks now. And the mayor has even called the FAA to find out, is this an authorized flight? And if so, who's doing it? And they say, yes, it's an authorized flight, but we're not telling you nothing because you don't have a need to know. So maybe the authorities want to find out what the time factor is, but I think there's something else going on. They can't wait for their drone. They got to put a manned aircraft up there and try to get the information. All right, earlier in the program tonight, we talked about taxation without representation, and we see that still happening. Hang on one moment. Sorry for the dead air there. Had to take care of something sticking out of the side of my finger. No, it wasn't a splinter. It was like a mother of all hangnails. All right. We know about taxes. We know how taxation is used. We also have read recently in the news that the IRS has been targeting conservative organizations. For instance, Tea Party organizations, other nonprofits out there operating. Now, we know that Democrats have been doing this ever since they've been in power. The IRS has taken down all kinds of criminals that Democrat administrations have not been able to capture. But they're also used to attack political enemies. And I've also told you that the president appoints all the secretaries of all the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations, and they work directly for him. In fact, it's illegal for Congress to step in. It's illegal for Congress to even call them. You cannot talk to them on the phone, cannot go visit them. Now, they could call them up and say, I want you to appear before my committee, and they'll come over and, you know, say nothing. But you cannot call the agency. You can't say, hey, wait a minute, this regulation, the way it's written, it says this, but the way you're applying it says that. That's not what we had in mind when we wrote the law. Sorry about that. That's illegal. But we also know that the president can call the secretary of that organization and say, I want this done. And it's done. And there's nothing anyone can do to stop it. In fact, the Supreme Court recently ruled that the president and his special health care program, now affectionately called Obamacare, can go into effect and they can force you to buy insurance, because they ruled that it is a tax. Well, now that it's underneath the IRS, you now see that the IRS is going to administer Obamacare. And sure enough, when Obamacare individuals' mandate takes effect in 2014, and those of you that filed your taxes with someone like H&R Block or something like that already know that this is unfolding. Because when you sat with your tax professional just a month ago and finished your taxes, your tax professional said, by the way, I noticed that you don't have health insurance. You realize that next year, if you don't have health insurance, approved health insurance, you're going to be fined $285. That's correct. And if you get the insurance, you get the approved insurance, then you won't be fined. But, of course, you're going to be spending one heck of a lot more than $285. You're going to be spending about $5,000 for that year's insurance. The next year, if you choose not to get health, the government-approved health insurance, your fine is going to double. It's going to be close to $600. Well, folks, the way I have it figured, I'm about $95,000 ahead of the game. My family had four kids. We had them, half of them in, with, we had them all with midwives, two in hospitals, two at home. We paid it all off ourselves, and we paid our own health care throughout our lives and did not have health insurance because we couldn't afford it. But the health care we could afford. And by the time we go back through the bills, we're about $95,000 ahead of the game. In other words, I bought and paid for my home with what I would have spent on health insurance. So, the new form that's going to come out, which is an IRS tax form, will require disclosure of a taxpayer's personal identifying health information in order to determine compliance with the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. So now, not only do you have to disclose how much money you made and how much money you spent if you have a small business, but you're also going to have to disclose your identifying health information. So you have to relinquish your right to privacy with income tax, and now you have to relinquish your right to privacy with respect to your health information. Not to your doctor, not to your insurance company, to the IRS. As confirmed by IRS testimony to the Tax Writing House Committee on Ways and Means, quote, taxpayers will file their tax returns reporting their health insurance coverage and or making a payment. So why will the Obama IRS require your personal identifying health information? Simply put, there is no way for the IRS to enforce Obamacare's individual mandate without such an invasion reporting scheme. Every January, health insurance companies across America will send out tax documents, not insurance documents, but tax documents to each insured individual. This tax document, a copy of which will be furnished to the IRS, must contain sufficient information for taxpayers to prove that they purchased government-qualifying health insurance under Obamacare. This new tax information document must, at a minimum, contain the name and health insurance identification number of the taxpayer, the name and tax ID number of the health insurance company, the number of months the taxpayer was covered by this insurance, and whether or not the plan was purchased in one of Obamacare's exchanges. This will involve millions of new tax documents landing in mailboxes across America every January, along with the usual rift of W-2s, 1098s, 1099s, blah, 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 interest statements and all of that. At tax time, the 140 million families who file a tax return will have to get acquainted with a brand new tax form. Since millions of these families will end up paying Obamacare's individual mandate non-compliance tax penalty, including yours truly. As a service to the public, Americans for Tax Reform has released a projected version of this tax form to help families and tax specialists prepare. Taxpayers may view the projected IRS form. All you have to do is go to ObamacareTaxForm.com. On the form, lines 3 to 4 show where taxpayers will disclose their personal health ID information. Now, the immigration reform measure the Senate began debating yesterday would create a national biometric database of virtually every adult in the U.S. in what privacy groups fear could be the first step to a ubiquitous national identification system. Now, this is an 800-page bipartisan legislation. Anytime I hear the word bipartisan, it means I'm going to get screwed from two sides at one time. Buried in the 800 pages is language mandating the creation of the innocuously named photo tool. Yes, it's a massive federal database administered by the Department of Homeland Security and contains names, ages, social security numbers, and photographs of everyone in the country with a driver's license or other state-issued photo ID. Employers would be obliged to look up every new hire in the database to verify that they match their photo. This piece of the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act is aimed at curbing employment of undocumented immigrants. But privacy advocates fear the inevitable mission creep ending with the proof of self being required at polling places to rent a house, to buy a gun, to open a bank account, acquire credit, board a plane, or even attend a sporting event or log on to the internet. Think of it as a government version of Foursquare, with Big Brother cataloging every check-in. Foursquare, it's an app. Don't get it on your phone. If you get it, dump it. It starts to change the relationship between the citizen and state. You do have to get permission to do things, said Chris Calabresi, a congressional lobbyist with the American Civil Liberties Union. More fundamentally, it could be the start of keeping a record of all things. For now, the legislation allows the database to be used solely for employment purposes. But, you know and I know, historically, such limitations don't last. The Social Security card, for example, was created to track your government retirement benefits and nothing else. Now you need it to purchase health insurance. The Social Security number itself is pretty ubiquitous in your life, Calabresi said. David Beer, an analyst with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, agrees with the ACLU's fears. The most worrying aspect is that this creates a principle of permission, basically to do certain activities and can be used to restrict activities. It's like a national ID system without the card. For the moment, the debate in the Senate Judiciary Committee is focused on the parameters of legalization for unauthorized immigrants, a border fence, and legal immigration in the future. Well, it doesn't stop there, because it's not just the photo. It could be an iris scan. It could be a DNA sample. It could be a thumbprint. The idea, of course, is to stop identity theft, is to be able to identify every single person that's inside the borders of the United States. We remember this. We've seen this before. We should have learned this in history before. You'll recall during World War II, the Jews were required to wear a yellow star or a gold star on their clothes. It had to be sewn on their clothes. Why? So the Jews could be identified. And if you were caught without your star, the punishment was severe. For a while in Germany, there toward the end, you had to have official identification papers. That's where, you know, the humorous part gets. You must have the papers. Well, it's getting like that in the United States. Why? Well, because over thousands of years of watching the history of immigrants over every continent in the world, we have seen that immigration, unchecked, unregulated immigration, is the destroyer of every single country. India's going through it. Jordan's going through it. Somalia's going through it. All these countries that get hundreds of thousands, millions, even hundreds of millions of undocumented people moving, migrating through their country, consuming everything in sight, producing nothing. This is what destroys nations. And so the Department of Homeland Security has now been tasked with pulling all that together and making sure that they identify everyone in the country. But seriously, is this really the role of government? Is this what we want our government doing? You think about it. You think it's a good idea, but you think about it. Also part of the biometrics, by the way, is, as I said, DNA. And maybe even infrared scanning. Did you know that Adrian Raine, in 1987, he's a neurocriminologist. He moved from Britain to the U.S. And his immigration was prompted by two things. The first was a sense of banging his head against a wall. Raine, who grew up in Darlington and is now a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, was a researcher of the biological basis for criminal behavior, which, with its echoes of Nazi eugenics, was perhaps the most taboo of all academic disciplines. He asked the question, do your genes, rather than upbringing, determine whether you will become a criminal? Well, he believed so, and breaking that taboo put him on a collision course with the world of science. In Britain, the causes of crime were allowed to be exclusively social and environmental, the result of disturbed or impoverished nurture rather than fated and genetic nature. To suggest otherwise, as Raine felt compelled to do, having studied under Richard Dawkins and been persuaded of the all-embracing influence of evolution on behavior, was to doom yourself to an absence of funding. That's a terrible thing in science. Because if you doom yourself to an absence of funding, you're going to be picking crumbs with the sparrows and you're not going to be able to publish anywhere. But in America, there seemed to be more open-mindedness on the question and, as a result, more money to explore it. There was also another good reason why Raine headed initially to California. There were more murderers to study than there were at home. When Raine started doing brain scans of murderers in American prisons, he was among the first researchers to apply the evolving science of brain imaging to violent criminality. His most comprehensive study in 1994 was still necessarily a small sample. He conducted PET, that's positron emission tomography. It means that they look at the shape or the morphology, the inner workings, physical workings of the brain, the layout of it, the temperature that it maintains during different kinds of thinking activities. Anyway, he did these scans of 41 convicted killers, and then he paired them with a normal control group of 41 people of similar age, weight, profile, etc. However limited the control, the colored images, which showed metabolic activity in different parts of the brain by displaying its heat signature, appeared striking in comparison. In particular, the murderers' brains showed what appeared to be a significant reduction in the development of the prefrontal cortex, that's the executive function section of the brain, compared with the control group. Now, the advancing understanding of neuroscience suggested that such a deficiency might result in an increased likelihood of a number of behaviors. Less control over the limbic system that generates primal emotions such as anger and rage, a greater addiction to risk, an adrenaline, a reduction in self-control, and poor problem-solving skills, all traits that might predispose a person to solving their problems with violence. Even two decades ago, these were difficult findings to publish. However, when Rain presented a far less controversial paper in 1994 to a peer group, one that showed a combination of birth complications and early maternal rejection in babies, had significant correlation with individuals becoming violent offenders 18 years later. It was denounced as racist and ideologically motivated, and according to Nature magazine, was simply further strong evidence that the uproar surrounding attempts to find biological causes for social problems will continue. Similarly, when 15 years ago, at the urging of his friend Jonathan Kellerman, the child psychologist and crime writer Rain put together a proposal for a book on some of his specific scientific findings. Well, guess what? No publisher would touch it. That book, called The Anatomy of Violence, a clear-headed, evidence-based, and carefully provocative account of Rain's 35 years of study, has only now been published, probably self-published. The reason for this delay seems mired in ideological enmities. For all Rain's rigor, his discipline of neurocriminology still remains tarnished, for some by associating with the 19th century phrenology, the belief that criminal behavior stemmed from defective brain organization, as evidenced in the shape of the skull. The idea was first proposed by the infamous Franz Josef Gall, who claimed to have identified over or underdeveloped brain organs that gave rise to specific character, the organ of destructiveness, of covetousness, and so on, which were recognizable to the phrenologist by bumps on the head. Phrenology was widely influential in criminal law in both the United States and Europe in the middle of the 1800s, and often used to support crude racial and class-based stereotypes of criminal behavior. Just watch Django Unchained and you'll know what I'm talking about. The divisive thinking was developed further in 1876 by Cesare Lombroso, an Italian surgeon, after he conducted a postmortem on a serial murderer and rapist. Lombroso discovered a hollow part of the killer's brain, where the cerebellum would be, from which he proposed that violent criminals were throwbacks to less evolved human types, again, identifiable by ape-like physical characteristics. The political manipulation of such hypothesis in the eugenics of movement eventually saw them wholly outlawed and discredited. As one result, after the Second World War, crime became attributable to economic and political factors or psychological disturbances, but not to biology. Prompted by advances in genetics and neuroscience, however, that consensus is increasingly fragile, and the implications of those scientific advances for law and for concepts such as culpability and responsibility are only now being tested. Now, I know that sounds like a lot of gobbledygook, but trust me, when you hear the rest of this, you're going to be amazed, because it is gaining ground. Rains is by no means alone in this argument. Though his highly readable book serves as an invaluable primer to both the science and the ethical concerns. As the polymath David Eagleman, director of neuroscience and law at Baylor College in Texas, recently pointed out, knowledge in this area has advanced to the point where it is perverse to be in denial. What are we to do, for example, Eagleman asks, with the fact that if you are a carrier of one particular set of genes, the probability that you will commit a violent crime is 4 times as high as it would be if you lacked those genes. You're 3 times as likely to commit a robbery, 5 times as likely to commit aggravated assault, 8 times as likely to be arrested for murder, and 13 times as likely to be arrested for a sexual offense. The overwhelming majority of prisoners carry these genes. 98.1% of death row inmates do. Can we honestly say that the carriers of those genes have exactly the same range of choices in their behavior as those who do not possess them? Now do you see where this is going? And if they do not, should they be judged and punished by the same standard? In other words, if you are caught, convicted of murder, should your sentence take into consideration the fact that you have a genetic propensity to commit those crimes and could not stop yourself? Whereas, if you do not have those genes, then you should know better, and there's no biological predisposition to do that. And so, therefore, you chose to do it, and therefore your punishment shall be different. Raine's work is full of this kind of statistic and this kind of question. One of his more startling findings is the extraordinarily high level of psychopathic markers among employees of a temping agency he studied. These are temporary employees that go. They can't hold down a full-time job, so they go to a temp agency. Psychopaths can't settle. They need to move around. They need to look for new stimulation, he says. He draws on a number of studies that show the links between brain development in particular and brain injury and impairment by extension and criminal violence. Already, legal defense teams, particularly in the U.S., are using brain scans and neuroscience as mitigating evidence in the trials of violent criminals and sex offenders. In this sense, Raine believes a proper public debate on the implications of his science is long overdue. Raine was, in part, drawn to his discipline by his own background. In the course of scanning his murderers, Raine also examined his own PET profile. And guess what he found? That the structure of his brain seemed to share more characteristics with the psychopathic murderers than with the control group. He laughs quickly when asked how that discovery felt. When you have a brain scan that looks like a serial killer's, it does give you pause, he said. And there were other factors. He has always had a markedly low heart rate, which his research has shown to be a truer indication of a capacity for violence than, say, smoking is a cause of lung cancer. He was plagued by cracked lips as a child, evidence of a riboflavin deficiency. That's another marker. He was born at home. He was a blue baby. All factors in the kind of developmental difficulties that might set his own researchers' alarm bells ringing. So, he says, I was on the spectrum. And in fact, I did have some issues. I was taken to the hospital aged 5 to have my stomach pumped. 5, because I drank a lot of alcohol. From age 9 to 11, I was pretty antisocial. I was in a gang. I smoked. I let car tires down. I set fire to mailboxes. And I fought a lot, even though I was quite small. But at that age, I burnt out of that somehow. At 11, I changed schools. I got more interested in studying and really became a different sort of kid, probably due to a good teacher. Still, when I was graduating and thinking, what shall I research? I looked back on the essays I'd written, and one of the best was on a biology of psychopaths. I was fascinated by that, partly, I think, because I had always wondered about that early behavior in myself. As Raine began to explore the subject more, He began to look at the reasons he became a researcher of violent criminality rather than a violent criminal. Recent studies suggest his biology might equally have propelled him toward other careers, a bomb disposal expert, a corporate executive, or a journalist that tend to attract individuals with those psychopathic traits. But we certainly do see a lot of psychopaths in journalism today. Despite his unusual brain structure, he didn't have the low IQ that is often apparent in killers or any cognitive dysfunction. Still, as he worked for 4 years interviewing people in prison, a lot of the time he was thinking, what stopped me being on their side of the bars? Raine's biology then was a good corrective to the seductive idea that our biology is our fate, and that a brain scan can tell us who we are. Even as he piles up evidence to show that people are not the free-thinking, rational agents they like to imagine themselves to be, entirely liberated from the limitations set by our inherited genes and our particular neuroanatomy, he never forgets that lesson. The question remains, however, that if these biomarkers do exist, and they exert an influence, and you begin to see the evidence as incontrovertible, then what should we do about them? What should society do about them? Perhaps we should do nothing, simply ignore them. Assume, when it comes to crime, that every individual has much the same brain, the same capacity to make moral choices as we tend to do now. As Raine suggests, the sociologist would say, if we concentrate on these biological things or even acknowledge them, we are immediately taking our eyes off other causes of criminal behavior, such as poverty, bad neighborhoods, poor nutrition, lack of education, and so on. All things that do need to change. And that concern is correct. It is why social scientists have fought this science for so long. The implication of neurocriminology, though, where it differs from the crude labeling of phrenology, say, is that the choice it presents is not an either-or between nurture and nature, but a more complex understanding of how our biology reacts with its environment. Reading Raine's account of the most recent research into these reactions, it seems to me quite new and surprising that environmental factors change the physical nature of the brain. So there might in lie the real evolution of the brain, not the evolution from generation to generation. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean the evolution of the brain inside the skull of the person that's actually growing and maturing. For instance, if you take a young child and you expose them to all kinds of interesting music, classical music and melodic music and piano and different kinds of instruments, you can build a structure, a physical structure in that brain that can accommodate critical and team thinking later in life. If that child in elementary school, for instance, plays in a band like middle school or high school band, the critical business organizational skills that are in the best business leaders of Harvard are usually the result. In other words, the brain hardwires itself based on the activities of forming those harmonies with other players in an organized way to create a sound which energizes the brain. Likewise, any sort of activity like playing on a team, as in a sports team or a chess club or an acting club or some kind of social event where people can build acceptance and a sense of accomplishment and success, also hardwires the brain. I'm talking about the evolution of the gray matter between your temples. It can change based upon the environment in which you place that person. No, it doesn't have to be wealth. In fact, a lot of times, struggle is good for the brain. It makes it think about things. We tend to talk about a child's development in terms of more esoteric ideas of mind rather than material brain structures. But the more you look at the data, the clearer the evidence that abuse or neglect or poor nutrition or prenatal smoking and drinking have a real effect on whether or not those healthy neural connections, which lead to behavior associated with maturity, self-control, empathy, etc., are made. The science of this is called epigenetics. It's the way our environment regulates the expression of our innate genetic code. Now, I can tell you that there are many very intelligent, very accomplished, very successful physicians and those that write about a physical development that support this idea of epigenetics, that providing a child with a great environment of success, of peace, of freedom from assault, of good nutrition, of helping them develop the spiritual expression of that soul inside that body, the establishment of the sovereignty and faith in that individual's capabilities, does have an effect. I have seen countless numbers of identical twins. You could not tell them apart when they were one or two or even five. But by the time they're 45, you can tell the difference between them. Now, they've been eating the same food. They've been wearing the same clothes, living in the same house, going to the same school, almost identical environments, with the exception of the soul that's inside that being, animating that physical body. That's the difference. And what you see over time, over that 45 years, is that the genes in one of those twin, identical twin individuals, compared to the expression of those genes in the other person, turns out to be different. Why? Because genes can make a variety of proteins. How does the gene choose which proteins to make in order to make the structure of the body, the shape, hair color, eye strength, wrinkles in the skin, body shape, muscle tone, even resistance to disease? It's set up by the environment created by the consciousness of that person in that body. And that's what makes the difference. One difficulty of embracing this epigenetical idea of crime, however, is the degree to which such factors should be taken into account in courts of law. This is where it gets pretty sticky. You can't say, you know, he's just a poor boy from a poor family. You can't just say stuff like that anymore. You can't take that into consideration of courts of law. There have been several landmark cases in recent years in which particular neurological disorders caused by blows to the skull or undetected tumors have resulted in arguable changes in character and behavior. And the violent or sexual crime is blamed on the disorder, not the individual. In most of these cases, it has been argued by the prosecution that brain imaging is prejudicial, that the brightly colored pictures are too compelling to a jury and more emotional than scientific. But if neural scanning becomes more routine and neuroscience more precise, will there not come a point where most violent behavior, that of the Boston bombers, let's say, or Newtown killer, is argued away in court as an illness rather than a crime? Now, Rain believes that this might well be. He even likens such a shift to our change in perception of cancer, actually until fairly recently often deemed the fault of the sufferer because of some repressive character trait. If we buy into the argument that for some people, factors beyond their control, factors in their biology, greatly raise the risk of them becoming offenders, can we justly turn a blind eye to that? Rain asks, is it really the fault of the innocent baby whose mother smoked heavily in pregnancy that he went on to commit crimes? Or if he was battered from pillar to post, or even if he was born with an abnormally low resting heart rate, how harshly should we punish him? How much should we say he's responsible? There is, and increasingly will be, an argument that he is not fully responsible. And therefore, when we come to think of punishment, should we be thinking of more benign institutions than prison or death? But then there is a further thought that if you start to see criminality as a biological illness, where does a sense of retributive justice stand? And it's not so much retributive justice. We were just talking about this the other day. Excuse me while I take a sip of my wonderful grapefruit juice. Okay, that was a gulp. If you have a jail, a prison, and prison system is a very, very big business all over the world, it's probably better run in the United States, but not necessarily so for the individual. I've often heard people who have been in jail that once you're out of jail, it's very difficult to stay out of jail. And, you know, I've interviewed them. I said, why is that? I mean, yeah, you went out, you did something wrong, you got caught, you went to jail, you did your time, now you're out. What do you mean you can't stay out of jail? Just obey the law. And they said, well, it's not that easy. Well, what do you mean it's not that easy? You don't just accidentally go out and disobey the law. I mean, you don't accidentally smash a driver's window in and steal somebody's iPad off of their console. You don't accidentally do that. You don't accidentally kick in someone's front door and steal their flat screen TV. You don't accidentally do that. You don't accidentally, you know, grab somebody on a sidewalk, hit them in the head and steal their wallet. I mean, come on. You could pretty much voluntarily obey laws like that. You don't have to put yourself in those situations. But what happens when people do that is they get incarcerated, which is what we call a jail or a prison. It's not so much the retributive system. In other words, we're not taking retribution. We're not necessarily wanting to take a punishment against this person. That's not the primary reason of the prison. The primary function of the prison is to get that person out of society, to remove him from society. Why? Because it's a known fact, absolute known fact, that almost 100% of the crime is committed by the same people over and over again. And so if you take that person and incarcerate them, you reduce society's risk. Okay, you can then walk the streets of your neighborhood because you know that all the sexual predators in your neighborhood have been caught and they've been removed from society. You can remove the bars from your store's windows and thus get in there to actually wash them and have a decent business without a cage that you're working inside of, because all the robbers, all the thieves, all the people that it would deal crack on your street and would therefore, you know, break in and steal just to get something to get high the next time, all those people are now in jail. They're removed from society. And so it's not so much a retributive justice stand that drives our criminal justice system. Rain himself was forced to face this dilemma when he became a victim of violent crime. As he recounts in his book, while on holiday in Turkey several years ago, a burglar entered his bedroom and in the struggle that followed tried to cut Rain's throat with a knife. Well, he fought the attacker off. But when the following morning he was presented with two possible suspects by police, he admits to not only choosing the one who looked most like a thug, the man later admitted the crime under duress, but also to wanting to visit on him the terror he had felt himself. I wasn't proud to discover. I was a bit Jekyll and Hyde. Perhaps we are all in that situation. Rain's Rain says, when I asked him about his response, the rational Dr. Jekyll knew that if I took this man's brain scan and found he had a prefrontal dysfunction, low resting heart rate, and a background of neglect, then of course I should cut him some slack. With understanding comes mercy. But to Mr. Hyde, the emotional voice in my head was saying nothing of the sort. He was saying, he cut my throat, I want to cut his. But that event changed me from someone dead set against the death penalty to someone who wouldn't be ruled out of a jury on a capital case in America. I think now my mind will always go backwards and forwards on this. The scientific understanding of the causes of crime versus being a human in society with all these gut reactions to people who commit awful crimes, it's a tough decision. If the neuroscience raises as many questions as it answers about culpability after a crime has been committed, what about its soul and role in crime prevention? And here, the questions seem no less confusing. One of them was posed a couple years ago by the arch-inquisitor Jeremy Paxman of Shami Chakrabarty, director of Liberty on Newsnight. If science could predict with 100% certainty who was going to commit a violent crime, would it be legitimate to act before they commit that crime? You remember the show Minority Report, don't you? Well, Chakrabarty was in no doubt. I would have to say that in a liberal society of human beings and not animals, my answer to your question would be no. But if such intervention could present Newtown or Hitler, you wonder, or Dunblane, would any of us be quite so certain? I mean, 6 million Jews would be alive. The fact is that the reality will always be a much grayer area, because even the most nuanced neuroscience will never produce a perfect prediction of human behavior. But is there a point at which the science, in identifying the possibility of repeat offending, for example, will be accurate enough to warrant routine scanning of those on the sexual offenders register? That would be a heck of a database. The fact is, Rain says, parole boards are making exactly these kinds of predictive decisions every day about which prisoner or young offender we are going to release early, often with lousy evidence. At the moment, the predictors are social and the behavioral factors, marital status, your past record, the amount of money you have, your skill level, your intelligence, even sometimes your color. What is not used are biological measures. But I believe that if we added those things even now into the equation, we could only improve the prediction. Rain cites two very recent brain imaging studies to back this up. One is a study in New Mexico in which prisoners are scanned on release. What they are discovering is that if the functioning of the anterior cingulate part of the limbic system is lower than normal before release, they are twice as likely to be reconvicted in the next 3 years. And that marker is a more accurate guide than all other social factors, Rain says. A second study apparently shows if a released prisoner has a significantly smaller volume in the amygdala, that's the almond-shaped part of the brain, crucial for processing memory and emotion, he or she is three times more likely to re-offend. Now, this is only two studies, but what they are beginning to show is proof of concept that if we added neurological factors into the equation, we could do a better job at predicting future behavior. And that's the way it is. That's the way the science is going. It's been a great pleasure to have you here on X Squared Radio tonight. I pray that you will look for the good in others and help it to grow a little bit every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. My heart goes out to all the mothers in the world. Happy Mother's Day. And don't forget, next month, Father's Day. So we're all in this together. Let's work and help each other, and before long, we will have saved the planet. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.